Welcome back to Search for DOS. In this episode, we meet Ben Marchette. Ben and I were introduced via my cousin Jamie and her husband Haggai. Ben and I have actually already recorded an episode. That audio, unfortunately, was lost. I don't know what happened with Podcastle, which is the software that I use to record these episodes. Fortunately, it's the only time it's ever happened. And Ben was kind enough to sign up for another discussion. So as you'll hear, we are very much laughing about the fact that episode one was never aired. But fortunately, episode two was recorded successfully. And you'll have the chance to meet Ben, learn about his leadership role as CEO of Impact Israel, and the organization that Impact Israel supports and is critical in the functioning of it. That organization is called Yamin Ord Youth Village, and it's located south of Haifa in the Carmel Mountains in Israel. And it's an interesting model that I, as an American, was immediately drawn to because, as you'll learn, they've developed a philosophy with how they approach educating these at-risk youth. Unlike a lot of institutions in America that focus on college matriculation and even more ambitious goals like Rhodes Scholars, Yamin Ord's focus on making their graduates productive citizens of society. And for a country as small as Israel, that's critical. They need everyone to be pulling their weight. And they've been doing this since 1953. And Ben is in charge and sits in the States and is critical with regards to pulling in supporters to ensure that Yamin Ord is able to achieve its goals. So I'm excited for you to meet Ben, hear about Yamin Ord, think about ways that maybe their philosophy could strengthen your own communities in the States. And if this is an organization you're interested in getting involved in, please reach out to Ben. As you'll hear, he looks to find ways to bring people to campus to see it firsthand. And it would be a great organization to support if this is, if education in Israel is something that is really important to you. Now, I give you Ben Marchette. Okay with it. I think we run it a little differently since we've already had episode one, but it never met the world. But I'm thinking it kind of, and just in general, I think it'd be fun to make it a little bit more kind of informal. And so I was gonna just kind of come in with some question that was like, we're almost in episode two.
Fair enough. Let's do it.
Okay.
Yeah. I love it. Good. And there's stuff to talk about too. I mean, it's, you know, things have changed in the last several months.
That's true. Well, Ben Marchette, welcome to Search for DOS.
I'm glad to be here. Glad to be back here with you,
That's
Tyler.
That's true. Back is right. Unfortunately, no one will ever hear episode one, but we're recording episode two here. Hopefully one day podcastle.ai will dig up that audio. You're actually the first person of all these episodes that's been done where somehow the audio just disappeared.
So, well, when it shows up again, we'll call it the prequel.
Yes. Yes. Ben Marchette strikes back. what's the prequel in Star Wars?
The prequel? I am not the good Star Wars person. I saw the first one, three when I was little, never got into those, sort of the second three. And now I've just totally lost track of how many there are, how many there, what there is, TV shows, other characters. I'm not a huge Star Wars fan, I'm afraid to admit.
Well, we'll have plenty of time to come up with the name of it, as I don't think Podcastle AI is focused on this, although we've both pinged them a handful of times.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's been a handful of months since we last met. What would you say is the biggest challenge that has popped up at Impact Israel? And for those who didn't listen to the first episode, which that makes everyone in the world, while you're explaining the biggest challenge that you all are facing, help us understand what Impact Israel is and what the underlying organization that it supports.
So I'll start by sharing just that. So Impact Israel, we are the primary financial driver of an ambitious endeavor to enhance the lives of at-risk youth in Israel across all boundaries. And we execute our work through two separate but connected channels. The first is called Yamin Or Youth Village, which is a school, home, and safe haven for around 400 immigrant and at-risk youth in Israel, atop Mount Carmel. It's been around since 1953, doing amazing work. They're really helping rebuild and reshape young people's lives. Since the late 70s, Yamin Or was led by a visionary, legendary educator named Dr. Chaim Perry. And Chaim Perry developed during his tenure at Yamin Or a concept, a methodology, and educational philosophy known as the Village Way. And in 2006, the leadership at Yamin Or, led by Chaim Perry, took that methodology and started bringing it to other schools and other communities working with at-risk populations across Israel. And at that point, the second arm of the organization, known as the Village Way Educational Initiatives, was born, to really to bring the magic of Yamin Or to schools and to young people all across Israel. We here at Impact Israel, we are, as I said, the chief financial driver. We are leading their partners in providing the funding and resources to make sure that they can do their work. And it is essential. We'll get into it, but I think it's probably in terms of the framing of why we do this work and why it's important is that Israel has one of the youngest populations in the world, certainly the youngest population in the developed world. And that's helped create, you know, this incredibly innovative and forward-thinking economy and culture and society for a long time. And that's great. But there's challenges there too, because a large percentage, around 13% of its young people, 0 to 18, are considered to be at risk, you know, at risk of negative outcomes in their life, whether it's crime, food insecurity, poverty. You think about all the bad outcomes that could happen in a young person's life. And so when you have a high percentage of at-risk youth, you have a large percentage of young people in the population, it creates risks actually for the country as a whole. And so our work is to try to address those issues now. And we work, our partners there work with teenagers, 14 to 19 around. And that is sort of that this, it's a period of grace, sort of the closing window of time where there's an opportunity to really make a difference in these folks' lives. So that's just a frame. But to get back to your question about what some of the challenges, I think, so since October 7th, you know, a lot of people have been describing not just describing Israel as an at-risk country. You know, everyone there has been suffering for intense and immense pain and suffering and trauma. And that certainly affected young people probably even to a greater extent than the population as a whole. And so there were a number of studies right after October 7th that said there were about 84% of all Israeli youth were suffering from emotional distress. So we knew then that was a significant problem. And then after now more than a year of war, you can see the damage and the struggles that the kids have been, that are facing kids. And so as we sit here now, at the beginning of 2025, more than a year since the initial attack of October 7th, we're seeing, you know, this sort of what happens after a year's worth of trauma and suffering and loss and concern and worry and how it weighs on kids. And so we're not in this emergency period now, but we are, it's in this period that there's this new normal that's descended upon all of Israel and certainly affecting acutely Israeli youth. And our partners have seen, you know, to get specific, you know, large uptick in addictive behaviors across the spectrum. Behavior issues, and the spikes are pronounced relative to prior years. And so I think it's certainly attributable to what's gone on and the experience that they've had for this last more than a year since October 7th. So there's some real challenges. And I think that, so how do we now, how does Israel move forward in this new normal? And how does it help? How do they help heal and rebuild?
In terms of the program itself, something that struck me when you described it to me the first time was the orientation isn't built toward something that I think we'd be used to in the America, which is college acceptance or even something more ambitious like Rhodes Scholars. You put it that's not the goal. It's not really elite outcomes per se. Could you share with us what the philosophy is around what the preferred outcome is for the youth?
Yeah, for sure. So academics are important, obviously, no doubt. It's an important element of a child's life. But that's not what it's not what the Village Way. It's not what our partners are focused on exclusively. We're not trying to turn these kids into Rhodes Scholars. We're not trying to get them into Harvard or even the Technion. Well, by the way, some do go. What the Village Way is about is how do we turn these young people into good contributing members of society, good citizens, people who are engaged. They're engaged with their communities. They're engaged with their families. They're engaged with their country. They're engaged politically. And that's really what this is about. How do we actually turn these people into people that are adding to the society and not taking from it? And you know, a lot of the kids, and they come, they're either at one of the schools we work with, or certainly at Yamin Ord. You know, they are always the recipients of aid and support, right? People are giving them food or clothing or help, however you want to describe it. And one of the things we teach them is that, no, you need to go help somebody. You need to be the one to go out. You're not just a victim. You're somebody who can actually make a difference in somebody else's life also. And you know, the Village Way, the methodology has, there's 10 elements, components to it. A key element of it is tikkun olam, which I think adds you to probably a different meaning in America than maybe it does in Israel in terms of its connection to Judaism. But in the Village Way in Israel, we teach that. It's like, how do you go do something that's better for your world? And it has incredible healing aspect of that when you get these kids to go out there to help others. And so that is right. That it'd be great if everybody could be a great student, but that's not really the goal. We want to turn this into, you know, a country of good people who are looking out for each other, who are helping each other.
What does your team do though when you have a student who, given their circumstances, is in a victimhood mindset, is, lack of a better word, emotionally damaged? What is the strategy to get them into that more proactive role and the feeling of wanting to engage in tikkun olam?
So it's there's a mantra that says, you know, when you're faced with some of these kids, like a kid who can be challenging, who can really sort of, you know, push you, or doesn't want to, or doesn't see the value in it, and, you know, is probably pushing back on a lot of things, we say, we say, we won't give in to you, but we won't give up on you. And so we're going to keep going. You keep going. You keep having that conversation. And maybe it doesn't not on day one, and maybe not on day two. But by years three and four, you can see this transformation in these kids, and things really, really come around for them. And there's also this sense and this really important element of the work that we do, that it's about, that's why I think about it. I say about that, we won't give up on you, but it's that family, you know, we're here for you. And a lot of the kids who, you know, who are, you know, fit this description of being at risk, or new immigrants who sometimes are coming to the country without their parents, sometimes with their parents, but who don't feel connected to the country, whose families probably don't feel yet connected to the country. They're lacking that sense of family. They don't have, first of all, they don't have the safety net. They don't have the connections. And so what we say is, how do we become that family for you? That we're not going to give up on you. And we put our money where our mouth is we actually, this is why we're not just a school. You mean ORD specifically, it's not just a school. It's a family. And we at You Mean ORD, there's a home for, it's called the home away from home for graduates. Somebody's in a bind, needs somewhere to stay for a while, can't make their rent, is in between apartments, whatever the case may be, they can come to You Mean ORD and stay there for a while. We provide scholarships for kids to get secondary, go to higher ed, whether be it vocational or university study. Sometimes they don't have them. We do scholarships for kids to go to gap year pre-military leadership training programs, so that when they do enter the Army, that they can be in positions to be in leadership roles and not just be grunts. So we stand with them, and we make sure that we're there with them, and we really are that kind of that family for them, because a lot of these kids don't have that, and that's a key element of what they need in terms of in order to succeed.
What percent of You Mean ORD alums end up serving in the IDF?
I'd look at the exact numbers, but I'd say we're probably in the 90%.
And will they serve after they already went?
After being at You Mean ORD? Yeah. So a key element also of our program, we believe really strongly in military and service in the IDF. You know, one of the things that I learned is interesting since I started this work, and I had a lot of experience living in Israel and working for Israel related causes for a long time. I always thought 100% conscription, everybody serves, everybody goes. And it's just not the case anymore. It's mostly the case still, but it's not always the case. And especially for kids on the periphery, the geographic and social periphery of Israel, there are outs for them to either do national service or do other things. Sometimes the Army doesn't even want those kids. Our belief is that military service in Israel is a key entry point to mainstream society for the, you know, in the short and long run. And as such, for our kids who are generally not part of mainstream society, how do we actually help them enter it with productive and service in the IDF? So we really encourage our kids to do it, and they mostly all do. They get a lot of pressure, some of these kids, from their families too, to go earn money. You know, they need the money. Don't go do that. And yes, your service in the IDF pays you some, but to go start really earning and be around and help take care of the family, we really push them to serve. And even more so, we really push them to do, as I mentioned earlier, these pre-military leadership programs, which are called Mechinot. Originally, these were started in the late 90s. For more well-off Israelis, communities began these programs to give their kids leg up when they entered the IDF. So it was a year's worth of training, leadership training mostly. And that when they entered the IDF a year later, these gave the kids who became officers. Those sort of things were out of reach. That kind of training was out of reach for the kids who are that you and I are talking about here. And Humidor'd actually launched the first one, the Met for young men, and then for women, Mechinot, Mechina for young people, for kids from the periphery. And it's been an incredible success because we've seen now these kids who are going to these Mechinot, whether it's Humidor'd, the ones Humidor'd started, or others across the country, because now they have sprung up for across the country for this kind of community, that they get that training and then they enter the IDF and they become great soldiers, great leaders, officers. And that's what we're really trying to do, is make sure that these kids have an opportunity to rise up and to find their way. And the military continues to be that important entry point for them.
And so Humidor'd, what year did the Village Way, that philosophy, become enshrined in the institution?
Yes. So Dr. Chaim Perry, who I mentioned earlier, he came to Humidor'd in 1977. And led the organization for the next three decades. In 2006, they launched the educational initiatives, taking that methodology that he developed over those years and starting to bring it to schools and communities across Israel.
And currently, how many institutions in Israel is the Village Way in?
We're in at 85 right now, and it's high schools, youth villages, which you can think of as a boarding school, but it's like Humidor'd, a lot more than that. But high schools, youth villages, we do work with the education corps of the IDF, as well as other elements of the security services. You know, it's an interesting part of the work, and when you're thinking about education in Israel, which we can get into a little bit about just the state of education in Israel, but probably the biggest educator in Israel is the IDF. I mean, if you think about it, you know, hundreds of thousands of, you know, 18-year-olds are entering every single year. You know, think about how many, when in the U.S., all those kids would be going off to college to go to school. In Israel, they're going to the IDF. And so the IDF continues to be actually an incredibly a source of education. And so we do work with the IDF and helping them train their commanders and their officers, so how they can work with their soldiers when they get there.
Does the IDF or other institutions in Israel pay Humidor'd for this? How is the transaction?
Yeah, no, they don't. There's no fee for service, which is one of the reasons I think that we I don't know if the reason why we're in such demand is because of that, but it does help. You know, a lot of these organizations and institutions, they know they can turn to Village Way educational initiatives. In Hebrew, it's known as Derech Kfar, the Village Way, to provide them guidance, direction, and support. But the funding is coming on that side of it. The funding is coming 100% from charitable donations from the U.S. and abroad, and some within Israel.
Which Impact Israel raises funds for?
Correct. Yeah. So Impact Israel is raising funds all across North America to support this work. Our partners are also raising money in Israel, and we're grateful. You know, I think that it's important. We believe, and I think a lot of folks share the notion that Israel, while having a large at-risk population, obviously, has also a lot of wealth and a lot of successful people. And we believe that, you know, it's important that that Israelis also invest in this as well, and they have some skin in the game, and that we want to, this is important, but we wanted them to be involved too. So the Israelis also are funding this. I should also just point out, just for as a point of clarification, so Humidor'd, which is a school and safe haven, as I said, and really atop Mount Carmel, their funding, they do receive their funding from the Ministry of Education to run the school, to pay for the teachers, to pay for the, mm-hmm. reading, writing, and arithmetic. What they don't pay for is to fill the gap. So they don't pay for the extracurriculars, they don't pay for the therapy, they don't pay for, the things that really are helping these kids find their way. They're paying for what happens in school from, 8-3.
So your CEO of Impact Israel, am I right to assume that one of the major components of this, in addition to fundraising, is telling the story of what your organization does, what it raises money for? Given that your CEO, you came into this 3 years ago now?
Yeah, just over 3 years ago.
What for you was, for the, like, looking at from a, like, a leadership lens, what was the biggest learning curve for you? What kind of, in hindsight, do you wish you knew going in?
So I came from a much larger organization and institution to this role. And I think the thing that I was taken aback by when I started here was how important and how crucial the back office is. All the administrative and operational details that come into running an organization. That was the part, you know, when I think I got here, I was from a small office, but a much larger organization. When I came here, I thought, oh, it'll just be like my small office. We're the same number of people. What would be so difficult? And I think I realized how important things like, you know, HR and finance and administration, how crucial those elements are to running a successful organization or business. I view them as the foundation. You know, without those things, you're gonna have trouble. You can get out and you can sell, or you can be raising as much money as possible, but if nobody can process the checks, you know, you got a problem.
So yeah, that clearly is a challenge, and you're doing it here in the States, and the entity that you're raising funds for and you're championing is pretty far away. And in this circumstance, in the country that is at war, how do you try to navigate that? How do you try to split your time between being in the States with people who are critical to the fundraising efforts and being on the ground where really the secret sauce exists?
Yeah. So, you know, that's also one of the challenges, I think, coming to an organization like this, is that the product or partners are halfway around the world. And how do you make the story of Yamin Ord and the Village Way relevant to audiences and to folks here in America? And we do that, by the way, in a few different ways. One, we get out and about and meeting with people, talking to people. We also bring our colleagues in from Israel. We bring in graduates, we bring in our staff to come and travel the country and to meet in folks' living rooms and at synagogues to talk about what the work they're doing, which is truly groundbreaking. So I think that's an important element of how do we bring Israel to and the story here. The challenges also, though, of having our partners there is that, I would love to go to Israel all the time. Since I started, which was the very end of 2021, the beginning of 2022, we've dealt with the end of COVID, which then we had a little bit of, I guess, leeway back in early 2023. But then we ran into, October 7th and, a war for the last year plus. So opportunities actually to get to Israel actually have not been as plentiful as I would have hoped. I was there just under a year ago, last March, meeting with our team and with kids and going to visit some of the schools that we're working with. It is a balance to try to figure out, the benefit of living in the world that we do today, luckily, is that there's so much we can do virtually, by video and obviously on the phone too, but by video to really bring our kids there. So, one of the things we launched this past year was building a webinar series where we're inviting folks to come meet and listen to our students and our graduates just to get a taste of what it is, what life is like on the ground for them, so they can get a feel for what's going on there. We need the airlines to start flying back to Israel again. That's an ongoing challenge. So hopefully that will happen soon.
Yeah, since October 7th, so much has changed. for obviously Israel, but for many people around the world, being an American Jew, there's been challenges that have presented themselves. I'm interested for you to share what it's been like for you, given that you're an American who has spent so much of his life focused on supporting our ally Israel. What has your view shifted on the country? Have some of the criticisms of Israel been kind of eye-opening to you? And then on the flip side of that, have some of the criticisms of Israel made you even more motivated to do your work? I imagine it's just been like kind of a tsunami of emotions, and you're once again someone who's dedicated so much his career to it. But I'm asking this question because I know that there's so many American Jews that have tried to they've been forced to struggle with this. So maybe hearing you talk through some of those emotions could be really helpful.
Yeah. So, you know, given my work throughout my career being around Israel, you know, I'm not naive, or I've certainly seen all the anti-Israel vitriol and the anti-Semitic vitriol that, you know, comes along with it. And I, probably like a lot of people, part of me says I would try to explain to everybody like how they're just wrong, right? And you can rationally explain now the arguments, the anti-Israel arguments, they just don't hold water. Then you realize like, it just, you know, sometimes it's not worth it. You know, it's not worth trying to engage with these folks who have these views. You know, I'm not going to convince them otherwise. However, I look at the work that our partners are doing in Israel, and those who are talking about apartheid, or that Israel's a racist country, or that Israel, that the Israelis are Nazis. I mean, just drive up to Mount Carmel, come take a walk around Imin Ord, and see the faces that are walking around on that campus. Go visit a village way school that's working in an Arab community in Israel, or a Druze community in Israel, Muslims, Christians, Jews, secular and Orthodox. And so when you see that Israel, which is really the sense of this ingathering of exiles, right? This Israel that's not, that it's the ingathering of the Jewish exiles, and there are other communities there too, and the respect for minority communities and populations there. And that's Israel I would hope that some of these folks would see. But I say I don't necessarily want to engage them in that debate, because I don't think they necessarily want to see it. It wouldn't fit their narrative. And so, you know, it doesn't really make sense to start arguing with them about it. So I try to like tune it out and focus on like, well, what can I do? What can I do just to make sure that Israel is uplifted, that Israel is strong, Israel can be supportive? And I'll just try to focus on like what I can do and what I can control. And I think, you know, our friends in Israel who are, you know, I'll tell you the interesting thing, you know, for this last year, you know, we've been reaching out to them saying, how are you? How are you? How are you? They, for the last year, have been reaching out to us asking how we are, because the news they're getting about what's going on in America is equally concerning to them as what we're seeing happening in Israel and what's going on in Gaza and Lebanon and everywhere else. So they've been reaching out saying, how are you? They, you know, one of my colleague Boaz, who you had the opportunity to meet, a month or so ago, was asking, you know, when he was out and about, like, should he wear his kippah? Should he take his kippah off when he's walking around, you know? And I said to him, no, you don't need to take your kippah off. You know, good of me to say, you know, he's about, you know, a foot taller than me and commands a tank battalion. So I figured he could take care of himself. But I think that what it spoke to is his sense of that. He said, like, is it unsafe walking the streets of America as a Jew, as a visible Jew, wearing a kippah. And so they're concerned about what's going on here. And I'm not naive to the reality of that, but I think it just shows that this sense of like, we're all worried about each other and we're all just trying to focus and just help each other and lift each other up. And that's, I guess, one of the things I think hopefully that's come from this experience, you know, since October 7th, that this bonding or deepening of the bond between Americans and Israel, and a sense of a shared mission. And I know that's obviously not uniform and it's not 100%, but my experience and folks that I talk to who may or may not be Jewish, may or may not have had interest in Israel prior, they've shown interest now and they want to be supportive and they care, because I think they see Israel as a, you know, democracy under siege and want to be there for Israel. And that's also been really heartening to see, because I do think there's been a rebirth of support, certainly in the Jewish community. We've seen it philanthropically, but I think across the board, I think you've seen it politically. There will always be those who are going to be outspoken and against Israel, but I think we've seen vast bipartisan support for Israel, and that's been really great to see.
You're unique amongst Americans, as you've spent so much time, well, you're American and you've spent so much time with Israelis. One of the things I was struck by was when I went on Birthright when I was 25 years old, was how different Israelis felt to me than Americans. And I definitely, I'd always thought of myself American before I was Jewish, but after Birthright, I very much felt that. And I've always communicated out that I'm an American Jew. I mean, I'm an American first and foremost. This is, and you know, obviously it's, you know, being Jewish in the world, sometimes people will go out of their way to kind of force that or flip it. But, you know, I'm proud of my American roots and feel grateful that Jews have such an important place in America. And so I'm interested for you to describe what are the core differences between Israelis and Americans, and how does that play into your work in trying to facilitate cooperation between Israel and U.S. donors?
Well, without being an anthropologist or a sociologist, my take on it, and you know, I lived in Israel when I was in college. I spent a junior year in college at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and have Israeli friends both from Israel and here in America, and so I definitely have some sense that I have some sense at least of some of the things that I think differentiate us. You know, I'd say first and foremost, however, you know, there is, Israel's a lot younger than we are. And I'm not talking about the population as I was at the beginning, but just as a nation, right? So 76 years for Israel, going on 77, you know, we are at 200 and closing in on 250, which is kind of hard to believe actually. So, you know, we're, you know, three times older than they are. So they're new, they're young. And so I think that first thing is that they're still finding their way. I mean, think about where we were in 1840. You know, that's essentially where Israel is today. So so I think that's first. The second thing that's related is that Israel is, you know, was born in and for 76 years has been in a constant state of war. There have been peaceful times, yes. Right. But so Israelis have a sense that I believe a sense of like a survival mentality, right? And a fighter's mentality. And they're looking out for each other and their community, they're very communal based. They're looking out for each other. And it's just different. They're, you know, how do you, if you're trying to survive every day, you might not have time to be thinking about pleasantries. You know, people always joke about, you know, you know, Israelis getting onto a bus, you know, in Israel, you know, pushing and shoving their way on. And, you know, here I am sitting in the back of the line waiting my turn, you know, but that's what they may not have so much, you know, time and energy for that. So I think that's, you know, part of the core difference is the sense of this Israel's a newer country, and just being in that state of war for its entire existence is very, very different. You know, the other thing, I guess, which is related to that, I do think is, you know, coming back to the military and the IDF, is that a lot of times in prior work here in the U.S., I had worked with young people. I had run a summer camp for a couple of years, a residential summer camp, and we, you know, brought in staff from Israel, and you would see this vast difference, right, in the Israeli staff who are young, and the U.S. staff who are young, you know, let's say early 20s, you know, and you know, after 3 years of service, 2 or 3 years of service in the IDF, there was a certain maturity level that the Israelis had that that the American young people did not have. And I do think that stems from, you know, this sense of service in the military, but the sense of national service and the sense that they were, you know, doing something that was, you know, greater than themselves. So I think those are some of the key elements.
Yeah, what are the elements that you think the U.S. should pull over? We're at this unique moment in our country where it seems like we're really questioning a lot of the status quo elements of society. Obviously, this past election was such a major shift in terms of what existed in the previous administration. And it just seems like there's a lot of conversations that are happening right now. So it feels like the ground is fertile to make some meaningful changes. What do you think should be done in terms of kind of elements of Israel that maybe you just described that you think should move on over? And then also vice versa, Israel's in this state of flux, right? What is the relationship going to be like for Israel with its own government? What is it going to look like in Gaza? What are some key changes? I know this is a massive question here that I'm asking you, but you know, if you were advising both nations, why don't you take one for each?
So for America, you know, I've been a big believer for a long time in this idea of national service. I think it's, you know, harder to execute probably in a country our size. But I think there's ways that it could probably happen. I think one of the challenges that I see, you know, as somebody who looks at and studies and tries to learn about the United States of America is, yeah, is this lack of this disconnect between the individual and the state. Mm. And how do you create a bond that helps people feel more connected, feel more patriotic, feel more committed to the country, but also to one another and to the idea of the country? You know, when I see, you know, in observing the election, this past election, and frankly, just observing the last, you know, 20 years, 16 years in American life, at the very least, you know, it's trite, but to say the divide that's become so pronounced between so many of us, and that we don't interact with those who disagree with our point of view or our perspective. And so how do we create opportunities for it to have this, you know, that people can connect on something that matters, to feel that there's something bigger than themselves, and that being the idea of America. You know, I'm a believer that this is, you know, the greatest country in the world that has the opportunity and, you know, has done more good for the world and has the opportunity to do so much good for the world because, you know, we were born with a whole new idea, right? You know, not this European model, ethnic rivalries in this history. We were brand new. And, you know, the founders and really were true geniuses to try to figure out how do we create a system that will allow, you know, fairness and equality. Well, they weren't always so perfect about that at the beginning, for everyone. And so we have this incredible opportunity here to be this new land, you know, that city on a hill. So anyways, I think that idea of national service could really go far in terms of helping people bond to the sense of what America is. Relatedly, by the way, and I haven't been in, I had been a teacher also in a previous life, but I haven't been back in a classroom in a long time. But I don't know what's going on with, you know, the teaching of American history these days. But I do think that, you know, education is a key element to it. I think Thomas Jefferson talked about that, that educators were going to be the key drivers of the success of the American experience in self-government. And I think that continues probably to be true, that that education is a key element for it. And then, you know, as a segue, you know, for Israel, I say the same thing. You know, Israel is suffering through some of the similar trends that we're experiencing too. You know, significant divide between folks left and right, religious and secular, and not really seeing eye to eye with each other, and not wanting to necessarily interact, and which is also why I think that the work that our friends, our partners are doing in Israel is so essential, because it's about how do you actually lift up lives, how do you make people feel connected to their communities, as I said at the beginning, to feel engaged with their politics, to be part of a movement that is uplifting individual lives, communities, and then a country. And I think similarly in Israel, educators are nation builders. There's a tradition in Jewish life of educators really being the leaders in their communities. And I think in what we're seeing in what the Village Way is doing is really reestablishing this notion of educators as nation builders. And if what we're doing at Yaminor and at these 85 Village Way communities across the country could be done in 850 schools and communities across the country, imagine the impact that could have in terms of uplifting those communities and the entire country. So I think those are some elements I think that can really be really helpful.
Well, I have no doubt if Thomas Jefferson was living today that he'd be interested in visiting Yaminor. That'd be quite the visit. Love to see TJ in modern outfit just strolling through Mount Carmel, or, you know, actually in his original garb.
Yeah, though
it's a great point about the education, and clearly we're struggling here in the States to teach civics. That is clearly such a weakness amongst youths, and then, you know, bleeds into the way in which your average American youth understands the conflict, the war in Gaza. It's a bunch of TikTok gobbledygook, and or some of the gobbledygook that they're learning in their actual classroom.
So that's true too. Yes,
big issue there. Well, you've been incredibly generous with your time, having already dedicated close to 2 hours to speak with me and to tell me about your role as CEO of Impact Israel. Why don't we conclude with explaining to us how do people get involved? How could someone at this point in time support what you're doing? I can imagine a couple profiles. You have someone who is in the States who really believes in education, sees what you all is doing is really compelling, wants to see it, wants to see why it's so successful in Israel, maybe bring it to the States. Another profile, someone who hadn't really thought much about Israel prior and sees so much good in the world because of Israel's fight to basically push back on all those who are trying to eliminate it, and is just inspired and feels like this is a good way to get involved. What's your advice?
Yeah, so first, anybody who's interested can go visit our website, impact-israel.org, and can learn more a lot there. anybody who's considering traveling to Israel, we would love to have you visit Yamin Ord or one of our partner schools. Go to the website, reach out to us through the email there. It's an experience. You know, until I took this job, I had never actually visited Yamin Ord. And when you get there and you walk up, you drive up to the top of the mountain, you reach a beautiful spot. But it's not just beautiful because of the view. It's beautiful for what you're seeing right there on the ground, which is, you know, what Israel was intended to be. And it's really a beautiful place. So if you're going to be in Israel, let us know. We'd love to have you visit, show you around, and let you get a taste of the work we're doing. And for folks who are who might be interested in getting involved, you know, we're in education, yes, but we're also in a resource-driven business. And so the support, we raise money from individuals and corporations and foundations across the country who are interested in investing in, you know, a better Israel. And we encourage you to invite anybody to get involved. Every dollar matters, and we're really grateful to hear from you as well.
Great. Well, Ben, thanks for laying that out. Thanks for joining me on Search for DOS. And I hope to one day be visiting Yamin Ord, seeing this incredible institution, and finding ways to have Yamin Ord and Israel teach America and bring some of that kind of bond that you talked about to the States. I think that'd be really powerful.
Thanks, Tyler. We can't wait to get you there. And I'm always grateful to talk to you. So we can go for part three, you know, a few months from now.
And we'll start thinking of how to title the episode.
Sounds good. No Star Wars references.